And no, that's not Junior Parker. That's a Junior Parker tune done by the great Seal Johnson, who's still with us, living in Chicago, but he's going to be in San Francisco next weekend at Biscuits and Blues for three nights, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And with any luck and technology working, do we have Seal Johnson on the line right now?
Oh, you sure do.
Oh, Seal.
I'll be singing that song, Driving Wheel.
Yeah, I man.
Don't have to work. You don't have to rob a steel. Yes, sir.
We have Seal Absolutely. Johnson. Seal Johnson, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing good.
That's wonderful. We had a little couple of minutes here where we had to get the phone straightened out, but we got them. And you're sitting at home in Chicago. Is the weather still pretty messed up out there?
Well, right now it's about 35 degrees, and it's kind of thawing out, but it's been really bad in Chicago.
It has, yeah. We've seen it on the news. Yeah, we've seen it on the news. Now, Seal, you were on this show back in 1999 when you came out and played Biscuits and Blues, and I didn't know that much about you. I'm ashamed to say that. And we had a nice little conversation, but it wasn't that deep because I didn't have that knowledge. And since 1999, a group of fellas in a company in Chicago called the Numero Group got together, and they reissue our different artists' whole catalogs, and they got together and they put out a box set on you, including an amazing book where they sat down with you and researched your whole life. And they in the liner notes of this book, they mention you allowed them to come into your home and get not just photos but information and the most in-depth discography on you is out now on the Numero Group, and I read this. It's actually a book of quite a few. It took me a couple hours, and I read it this week. And your story, Seal, is amazing. It goes back to, I just want to just briefly touch on a few points and tell me if I'm wrong, but it goes back to Mississippi where you were born. It goes it goes back to you and your brother learning guitar the old-fashioned way with a wire on a board. Because, you know, you guys finally did get a guitar when you were younger, but you made it to Chicago. Your parents moved up there, and that was another story in itself. And when you and in the book, I read that one of your first days there, and you having learned guitar down in Mississippi, out on the stoop next to your house was a young kid, and his name was Sam Maggett. He went on to become...
He was sitting on the steps right next door to my mom's house.
He went on to become Magic Sam. And in the book, it says, quoting you, it says that you sat down with him, and he was playing more country stuff because that was more popular at that time, and you showed him his first blues licks.
Yeah, I showed him a few blues. I showed him. While we got together, man, we brought the police in the neighborhood. His mom got me an amp and a guitar, an electric guitar. And we put the amps in the window, and we went to work. And I taught him, you know, like Muddy Waters and the Howlin' Wolf type of stuff.
Yeah, you were more steeped in the blues. And Sam went on to become, we all know, Magic Sam. He died very young. You guys were very close right up until his death. You guys were best of friends. And you went on, Seal, to have a career of your own in that blues world. Early on, you played with Jimmy...
Not quite. It wasn't too much in the blues world. It was R&B. Yeah, a little bit in the blues world, because I started out with Four Aces.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about, and a lot of people might not know this about you. Little Walter had... Junior Wells had a band, and it was the Aces, and he left... And Lil Walter came in and took that band, and that band was a band unto themselves. It was Fred Belo and Lewis Myers and Dave Myers, the two brothers, and they were called the Aces. And it turns out you were in that band. You were the fourth ace.
And that
doesn't get talked about a lot.
That's when I first met Buddy Guy. He comes to the 708 Club, and I was playing in that band, sitting up behind the bar, and that's when I first met Buddy Guy.
That, and you guys were both young men together, weren't you?
Very young. We weren't even men then. We were boys, yeah.
And what's
he went on and became a phenomenon.
Sure, he sure did.
Went on, I stayed in the blues for a while. I recorded with a lot of blues acts and then the bingo. But I went on in 59, and I cut for King Records, and I cut Teardrops. And that was like R&B. I wanted to do R&B, and that's on that box set there, that Teardrops. And that,
can we hear a little piece of that right now, Syl? Teardrops? Here's the original Teardrops, Syl Johnson, for Federal King Records. That's Syl Johnson on the Federal label. And Syl, you gonna
do you treat me this way?
You gonna sing
that?
That
I love you.
Are you gonna sing that song next week in San Francisco?
Night and day.
Go, Syl.
Darling, what can I do?
Yeah, baby.
Teardrop, shed my teardrops for you. Thank God.
Do you still sing that song today, Syl, in performance when you go perform?
I got so many to sing. I had a singer when I was in Australia.
Wow.
And the promoter said, no, you got to do it.
I didn't know it, but
he said, you have to do it. And I said, what? He said, you're going to have to do it. I said, well, I don't know the lyrics that well. He said, I had to write them out for you. Now I know the lyrics pretty good.
Very good, very good. Your story, and again, I want to touch on this. It's so deep. Before you, and that's a whole story how you ended up at Federal Records. But before that, in your dealings in the blues world, you ended up going on the road with Jimmy Reed as his guitar player.
Oh wow!
Speak about that. Speak about playing, backing up Jimmy Reed.
Oh wow! Oh, my goodness. He drank a lot. You know, you see how the guitar players now have their strings. When they put their strings off,
yeah,
they'd be all tumbled up one way up on the neck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You notice that?
Yeah.
That's a Jimmy Reed style. He'd be so drunk. He didn't put it on. He didn't try to tail make it play. He just stick it in there and punt it. We used to do sessions. We used to get three sessions. Because he couldn't cut until he could damn it. Oh, excuse the expression. I'm sorry, y'all.
Damn is okay. Damn is not swearing. It's okay.
Okay, good for me. He get almost drunk. We had to wait for him to get drunk. If we get drunk, he's ready to cut his record there. You got me running. You got me high. He'd be drunk.
What were you able to take away from that experience with Jimmy Reed besides finding out that you didn't want to become a raging alcoholic?
He was just ornated. I saw him one time, boy, the house was so packed, and we were somewhere in Florida. And I'm watching him because I'm playing guitar, you know, I could see everything, and his son was standing right beside me. And the women were so excited, they were so packed, they were throwing their panties up there at him.
Wow.
Oh, he said, I got to pee. He had a long cable on his guitar. He wouldn't pee behind the curtain.
Oh,
I'm looking
man.
Right at him on the big band, on the stage.
Oh, man. That's
the stage was like a theater, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I just had to take a piss.
That's some...
He knocked him dead.
You know, that's another notorious Jimmy Reed alcohol story. But musically, what did you take away from playing with Jimmy Reed? Because he did have that. He had something that captivated people to the point where, like you said, women were just enthralled by him and kids. And he crossed the color line, too, didn't he? And white kids and black kids loved him.
Some places in the South, They lock him up. Time to get in town.
Yeah, yeah, because everybody wanted to see him, right? Black and white.
They did, but the police department know that he might probably get drunk, he won't show up.
Uh-huh.
They lock him up.
Wow.
And bring him to the gig.
Man.
I was in the hallway, watched a few times, and I was drinking some Coke. He grabbed the Coke out of my hand and drinking it, and he thought some whiskey was in it.
We're talking to Syl Johnson. Syl Johnson is in Chicago right now, completely okay. And Syl, you're going to be in San Francisco at Biscuits and Blues next Thursday, Friday, Saturday, this coming. And you were here in 99 for a couple of nights. And how do you feel about coming back to San Francisco for a three-night run?
I feel great about it. I left my heart in San Francisco, so I'm coming back to pick up my heart. No, but back to Jimmy Reed, you asked me a question. What I found was drink in moderation. Don't just drink all the time, you know. You can't live, and you won't be able to live as long as I live and have a voice like I got.
Definitely.
If you just drink all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And
you know how to drink? Drinking is okay. My doctors say I should drink red wine every time I eat my food, and it's good for my heart. But see, that's to show you the drinking is cool.
Yeah,
but drink too much.
Like you said, in moderation. Let's touch back on this music part now. After the kids of your generation were coming into their 20s in the 60s, and what that meant was that. That generation kind of didn't really stick to the blues. They weren't in love with that old blues sound as much as their elders were. You guys came up with a sound of your own, just like the next generation after you and the next generation after that. Every generation comes up with their own sound. And you guys came up with soul music. And I say you guys because you were part of a movement of that whole generation that created what we now know as soul, and you had your own unique sound, like we just heard in Teardrops, that you were breaking out. You weren't going to stay in that blues bag. And talk about the transition, how that happened for you, where you had played with Jimmy Reed, you had played in the Aces, you knew Buddy Guy, you were in the ghetto playing the blues, and then all of a sudden, just through what was it in you that just broke out and said, "No, I want to do this. I want to do this stuff."
I can tell you why. You know, I went to school. We learned music. We learned chord change, rudiments of music,
mm-hmm.
and we learned the syncopation of music and the beats and what they stood for, and different chord changes. And when we learn all the different chord changes other than 1-4-5, then we start to add the rhythm to that blues. And we put rhythm to it because we were younger and we wanted the rhythm, different beats. And see, the blues has got 1-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2- but he didn't write the blues. He said, I know what they're playing. So he transcribed and put it on paper. But the blues came out the clear blue sky for these people in the cotton fields, and they didn't know what it was. So when I got up with the younger people started studying music, they started learning chord change, the minor 7, the 6-9, the major 7, the 13th, the diminished chord.
Yeah.
Oh, and they put that together, and out of each chord, there is a melody in that particular chord.
Now, did the church have anything to do with it, with your generation?
Say what now?
Did the church have anything to do with it?
Well, the church was before the blues. See, the church was before the blues. The old Negro, he sang in the church, and then the white man let him have a little freedom, and then he went in the separate Duke Church, the separate club, and he said, Sally Mae, Sally Mae. Girl, don't you hear me calling you?
Oh.
Blue song was always, he was singing about Lucille, Lucille. Oh, Black Mary, she ain't got change and clothes.
Oh,
got mad and throwed her trunk I door.
Ooh, listen to
I
Sil.
Got a cold black mare.
Yeah.
Hold on, how that horse can run. You know.
Now that's
and
that's straight
on,
blues.
Baby,
now,
don't you wanna go?
But when your generation was coming up. A lot of you guys were in church on Sundays. I don't know if you guys were church going guys, but the church had those church chords, that gospel sound seems to have bled into, besides just your schooling at school, because soul music seemed to be a mixture of the blues and the gospel together, kind of like what Ray Charles did.
And jazz too.
And there you go. And jazz too. And
bebop. See, when he went up north and he got slick with the saxophone player, and they started bebopping it up.
Uh huh.
They called it bebop. Bebop is related to hip hop.
Now, did the radio have a part to play in that? What was the radio like for you when you were a teenager? What were you hearing on the radio?
Country.
That's it.
We call it hillbilly music.
Okay. Were you hearing any jazz?
And no.
Okay. And you were obviously hearing blues, for sure, right?
Just a little bit. They had a blues hour, and that was it.
Wow. So out of that, though, came this soul sound, and you were one of the main purveyors of it, Sil. It's funny because... in this book that I read in the liner notes of this great box set out on you, the Numero Group put out, it talks about the fact that, as a matter of fact, I want to quote a little bit out of the book because I think it was very poignant. To hear him tell it, Sil Johnson could have been as big as James Brown or Al Green. Number one on the charts, top billing on the marquee, Hall of Fame inductions, tearful tributes, all within his reach and yet never in his hands. Something, someone, sometimes, if you believe his lyrics, the sole of a shoe was holding him back. And one of your greatest songs, they quote it now, was it because he was black? And then
stop right there.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to tell you what James Brown was. When I got to King, I was young, and James Brown was hot commodity at the time.
Hot as a firecracker.
So James Brown was a bumper zone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
All the promotion and all the emphasis went towards James Brown, the big gun. So I was kind of like a sidekick. But I held my own, and therefore I came through. Same as when I went to Decker London High. That was Al Green. And he was bigger than bubblegum when I got there. He had just broke big.
Yeah.
So he was a bumper zone.
Yeah.
But how do you like me now? Come to find out that my music was nominated a Grammy and the Young Cannibals a record, She Drives Me Crazy, and my music was on the other side called Rip the Shuckle Off. Theoretically, I won a Grammy.
Uh-huh.
And I was at the Grammys in 2012. My music was in the Kanye West and Jay-Z album, Watch the Throne. My music was in the cut called Joy. That album won a Grammy. So theoretically, I won a Grammy there.
Exactly.
I was nominated for a Grammy in that same ceremony from against Elvis Presley, which is not a superstar. He's an icon. And against Paul McCartney, he's an icon. They're
sure.
More than superstars.
Sure.
So I don't think that I failed too much at this point right now.
No, no.
Now
this
I come to find out that my record is in a video game called Grand Theft Auto, which has sold from 2004 till now 1 billion copies. I didn't say million; I said billion.
Your music is in Grand Theft Auto?
Yes, sir.
That is incredible. Now, Sil, I want to get to that, but I want to work our way up to it because yes, you've been sampled. And you got paid, and Wu-Tang and a whole lot of other groups helped you have a. You're very comfortable now in the sense that
they didn't help me.
That's true. They didn't help you, but their music did. Their music did. You had to go to court.
Liu Kang said, no, you don't have to go to court. I sent them the lawsuit. They said, we'll pay you.
That's great.
And Kid Rock said, no, for Cowboy. He said, no, I'll pay you.
That's great. And you have a big relationship with Johnny Lang, too.
Oh, Johnny Lang, I met him when he was 13. He said he was so nervous. He said, I'm going to do some of your music.
And he did.
He made an album with me, too.
He
was on one of my albums.
Yes.
He did one of my songs, and it went platinum. It went triple platinum.
Yes.
Here I come. And I'm going to open up the show with the song that Johnny Lang did, Back for a Taste of Your Love. He did it on the album called Lie to Me. And I met him when he was 13. He said he'd been playing my music ever since he was 5.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. And Johnny took you on the road early on, too, didn't he?
Yeah, I went on the road and played some gigs with him. He was hot as fire.
That's amazing.
He loved him.
In case you just tuned in, folks, we're talking to Cyl Johnson. This is a soul music icon who is still alive and well, still playing, living in Chicago. And he'll be in San Francisco at Biscuits and Blues next Thursday, Friday, Saturday for a 3-night run, 2 shows a night. And so what I'd like to do is just let me see if I can jar a little bit of that memory, too. Here's one. You called it This Heart of Mine. Let's do a little touch of this, a little taste of this, and see what you remember. Not too much. We'll get him to sing it for live next week. Cyl Johnson, what kind of memories does that bring back?
I can't hardly remember that song. I forgot I made it.
Well, you told me that there were songs on this box set that they dug up that you didn't know existed.
Yeah, I forgot that I had made them.
That must be amazing, though, to have that kind of that depth of a career that... There's music out there that you had forgotten that you made.
Yeah, well, I'm happy that these guys did the research they did, and they did some hell of a research.
Definitely.
I had a good band, and sometimes I would make tapes, make an old 45, and sell a couple copies in the stores, and the stores would get it, and they just use it as a cutout. And these guys was a hell of a researcher. They found them.
And in the liner notes, the book that I read, I want to touch on that a little bit too. So, you were a jack of all trades. You made it happen, whether you had the big label backing or not, to the point where you created your own label.
Yes.
And you got to the point where you'd make a record. And if you couldn't get that distribution deal, you'd get it out there one way or another. Some of your records broke big, and they just broke out. You know, speak about some of those breakouts where you didn't even know. You put this record out, and maybe you put 2 or 3 out, and then all of a sudden one of these hit, and it just went like wildfire. And for a little bit there, you were hotter than a firecracker and in demand all over the country. Speak about that, those days when you were just on fire at times with those single records.
I started, I had to start my own label because I ran into the problems with James Brown, and he was the big gun,
mm-hmm.
So I was an entrepreneur, and I was starting my own label, and I started this Twilight, L-I-G-H-T,
mm-hmm.
And I went in business with a guy by the name of Howard Bednall. And he had a guy by the name of Mr. PM, and there was a secretary, and Mr. Bednow got in payola trouble because he was the king of the,
They had some problems, right?
They had problems. They thought he was taking payola and doing payola from for his record store. So he kind of shifted it out of his hand into Mr. P.W.'s hand. And Mr. P.W. said, well, I got a guy here and another guy here. He's black, and I'm taking this. And he took it and called it Twilight.
They changed the name on you, and they got control of it.
Yeah, and took it, and I, for 40 years, I couldn't do nothing about it, and I just left. After 3-4 years, I didn't get no money. Mm-hmm. I went to high. But later in the back, and let me tell this story. It came back again where these rappers were sampling the music on Twilight.
Mm-hmm.
Twilight. So this Mr. P.W. got in wind of me making money off of him. He come back and said, it's mine again. But thank God to the courts and to Judge John F. Grady, United States District Court, and he's white.
Uh-huh.
And he's, some people say 87. Yeah, I went to court. He took it to trial within a year and, I think, 3 months. He says, go on the trial. You've been in here too long. I looked at him. I said, whoa, Judge, to myself. He says, he's got to go to trial. He says, go on the trial. So they didn't go to trial. They settled with me. So after 40 years, I own all the rights to all the masters that I made, and therefore I could make this deal with the Numero Group free and clear with all my masters that I made. And so now I got a few tears in my eyes, but that's okay. That's how life is. There are some good people. This judge is white, and he's old.
And that his brings up
John Fitzgerald. John F. Grady,
mm-hmm.
United States District Court, Northern District, Eastern Division.
Mm-hmm. You had to sue for your rights, but you got them. And that brings up another point, too. In the book I read, in this great Numero box set, that after Martin Luther King got assassinated, a lot of black folks in the country, artists, wanted to make statements, and you wanted to make one, too. And you mentioned in the book that you didn't want to be hateful. You didn't want to be negative. So you came up with a question. And the question was, is it because I'm black? And you made this. And this is one of those songs. And it turned into an album that blew up. It completely blew up and became an anthem for African Americans in the country. It became one of those songs because it says in the book, the phone calls to radio stations for requests of this song outnumbered it. It went beyond anything. It was just incredible. Speak a little bit about you writing this song, and we're going to play it. I'll play a little bit of it right after you talk about this. Speak about writing that song, because you didn't seem to have a real heavy political musical career. Your music wasn't really activist, but this one song broke you out of the pack and set you in a place that, well, you really spoke the truth, and it really spoke to everybody. And speak about the effect it had on the neighborhood.
I will give it to you like this. You know, they're talking about a woman and a man sitting there making the same, doing the same work, and most of the time the woman, she works harder because she want to be counted for.
Mm-hmm.
But the woman get less money than the male.
Right.
We know this.
Yes.
Why?
Because they're a woman.
Because they're female? That's a good question.
Yeah.
So, there are people in this country that have nothing to do with slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them come immigrants. They didn't have nothing to do with their grandparents. They struggled to get here.
Mm-hmm.
They had nothing to do with it. But then I wanted to make something related to that particular situation for the poor, pitiful blacks that were slavery. So I put it on the conscience of the mind. Dr. Martin Luther King was working to help the garbage people, moving those stinking nasty garbage, and they shot him in the face.
Yeah.
Why?
Right.
Because they thought, listen, they could get away with it. Why? Because he was less thought of, he was black, we can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
They get away with it easy. You look at the zebra, the lion. She's looking, she's hungry. She looks at the zebras, and one zebra limps. Oh, that's the one she wants. And she's going to get the one that limps. Why? Do you know why? Because he's easier to bring down.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Yes, definitely. Seal Johnson is our guest right now, and we're speaking about the question that Seal asked right in a song right after Martin Luther King got shot, and it reverberated not only through the African-American community, but through all of America. And here's the question.
Skin only add color to my tears. Oh, oh, that splash against my hollow bones that rocks my soul. Oh, 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 oh. Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew. Wondering why my dreams never came true. Is it because I'm black? Somebody tell me, what can I do? Oh, Lord. Oh, something is holding me back. Is it because I'm black? Yeah.
Seal Johnson. Seal, what kind of impact did that have on the neighborhood when you put that out?
As I was talking to Craig Charles with BBC, big BBC, you're familiar with BBC.
Sure.
Right? He told me Billy Paul, you know Billy Paul.
Yeah.
Billy Paul said he lost his rapport with white people because he made a song called Am I Black Enough For You? Well, that's arrogant, I told him.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a question here.
Yeah.
My great-grandfather's name was Wallace. He was a slave.
Wow.
He was appraised on the plantation when he was 14 for $450.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
Listen. I want you to listen to it.
We're listening.
He had four sons, Joe, Will, Dan, and Owen. My name is Thompson, really, not Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Thompson. The land is called Section 24, Township 2, Rain, Marshall County, Mississippi. They bought the plantation that he was a slave on, Section 24, Township 2, Range 2, Marshall County, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, all of that was a part of my thinking, because I knew about that land that they bought. He was his father, my grandfather's father, was a slave on the same land. Good God Almighty!
That's amazing, Sue, and that connects it right there.
So I couldn't have animosity toward no particular people. Now, I'm going to tell you another story. Almost 100% of my people now, and they're not people, typical people that go to the blues, Biscayne blues. I travel throughout the world, and the fans are 18 to 29. Now, they love that old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they're 100% almost whites.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, they see, it's like old wine. Old with the old brandy.
Still, you are. You're like old wine.
They're young, but they recognize authentic, organic.
Yes, yes. Yes.
You can't fool them. They're young. They got good ears and good minds.
That's right.
And I ain't saying they're smarter than blacks. But, I mean, they're smart people, and they recognize the real deal.
Oh, yeah. In fact, it seems...
Prejudice. They just want to hear the real stuff, man.
Right, right. I think the younger generation has gotten beyond the color barrier, beyond where we were, and I think they've... They haven't completely erased it, but I think that the younger generation has reached a point now where that color barrier isn't what it used to be. But your song, getting back to the impact of your song, still, it still reverberates. I still hear it on the radio today. I hear it on political talk shows for folks that want to make a point. They'll, if they're talking about that subject, they'll use your song as a backdrop for that. And I just want to say... For the entire audience, for all of us, black and white, thank you for making that song, because I think it made the world a better place.
Okay, let me just tell this to you. There's a company that's doing a documentary on Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
They're using 1 minute and 22 seconds of that particular song.
There you go. There you go.
I did a show in Australia a few months ago. And the crowd was, like I say, 18 to 29 was the crowd. And look, I mean, it was so crowded till you couldn't hardly breathe.
Hmm.
And the people, when I hit that song, these people just went wild.
That must make
and
you...
And they were like 100% whites.
Mm-hmm. That must make you feel great, so.
Well, it makes me understand the way, see, the Bible said the Spirit of God moved on the face of the water.
Sure.
God ain't moved on the water. That when I look out in the crowd, it looks like the people's faces look like little waves. The Spirit of God moved in the people. All life came from water. Am I correct?
Sure.
So that's why the Spirit of Truth moved in the people. Oh,
that's some deep stuff. Syl Johnson.
That's common sense.
Yeah, they definitely.
They don't care about no color.
Definitely.
But the reason why the color barrier is there, they try to make slaves out of Mexican, Indians,
white
folks. But they couldn't. They did it because they were different. You sure, you know that they could be a slave, but that look at the color. That's all it was.
That's right. That's right. Now, Syl, to this...
I have no animosity towards no people in the world.
Oh, we could tell that by that song. We all know that. To this day, Syl, you are one of the godfathers of what they refer to as funk.
I kind of want to
shift gears here, because you made your way down to Memphis from Chicago, as did Al Green, and we all know where Al Green blew up and everything, and you guys were kind of touring together. You were on the same label, and I don't know if you were touring together, but a song came up that Al had written. And I don't know if Al gave you the song or if Al gave it to the producer, but the song came up and the song was given to you, and you recorded it.
Let me tell you how it happened.
Okay.
Al Green told Willie Mitchell, now you're kind of running too close into my groove. So let me write you one for Syl Johnson. Now notice the beat, the bass act. That's the funky. He said, so Willie Mitchell called me. I was in London, England at the Kinoid International Hotel. He said, Al Green wrote a song for you. I said, what? He said, yeah. See, you're going to like it. I was a little jealous at the time. Well, you know. He said, you're going to like it. And he sent it to me. And Al Green, Al Green had did it. And that was the demo he talked about. I'm talking about a friend of mine, little Junior Pop. But Willie Mitchell sent me this song, and I got home, I had it, and my wife, we went down in the studio, and she had a tablet. She wrote across the tablet, instant smash.
Wow. And this was before Al Green recorded it. You were the first one to record this song. We're talking about Take Me to the River, a song that's been covered by more people than most any songs ever. And you were the first one to record it. After that, Al took it, recorded it himself. And whether his song sold more copies, it doesn't matter. What you did, and I want people to hear this now, because you're not just a guitar player and you're not just a singer. You're a harmonica player, too. And a lot of people might not know this. You sat in and played harmonica with my band, and you killed me. 15 years ago, you killed me right here in just above Palo Alto. Let's hear a little bit of this song here. Johnson with his version, the original, written by Al Green but given to Sill through Willie Mitchell, the producer. Sill, what did that song do to you when you did it, man? Because I'll tell you, it kills me every time I hear it.
That's a hit.
It was a hit, wasn't it? Your wife was right, right?
Yeah, it was a big hit. It was a pop hit. It was the biggest pop hit I had.
It crossed over, didn't it?
They're big. Well, I had some crossovers, but that was the biggest crossover.
Yeah, and to this day, you know, when Take Me to the River comes up, more times than none, people play Al Green's version, but I prefer yours because I love that harmonica in there, and it's funky. It's funky, and that's what you are, Phil. Sill, you are funky.
Oh, thank you, sir. I smell funky.
Now,
are you saying that I smell funky?
No. I can't smell you from here, Sil. Now, we're going to wrap up now. We're getting short on time. It's been almost an hour, though, and I just appreciate your time, Sil. Sil, you're getting ready to come out here next week, this coming week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday at Biscuits and Blues. And I know you've been taking care of yourself because you sound great. And I'm not going to ask you. I'm not going to ask you how old you are, but I know you're over 50.
I'm old enough, but not too old.
There you go. You're coming back for a taste of some of this love in the Bay Area, right?
Yes, sir. I'm coming. I'm holding up with that song.
Yes, definitely. We want to encourage people, if they want to find out more about Sill Johnson, they can get the Numero Group box set, the complete discology. It's a great book. It's a box set. It's vinyl and it's CDs, and it's amazing. It changed my life. And Sill, in the meantime, do you got anything you'd like to say to the Bay Area while we got them on the line here?
Well, I'm just looking forward to seeing people in the Bay Area, and I want to come to the warm weather and enjoy myself in the warm weather.
And it looks like we're going to have some warm weather. We're going to have some warm weather for you, too.
It's been extremely cold in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So I just can't wait to get in the Knock 'em Dead and the Biscuits and Blues. As you call my show, I'm a rhythm and blues man, but I got to do some blues.
There you go.
Because it's Biscuits and Blues. I'm as good on blues as I am on funk. because blues is where I got my start.
There you go.
And I just put some rhythm to it and some color. That's all it is, and some chord changes. Just rather than using the 1, 4, and 5, I use the 6-9, the dominant 7, raised 9, the minor 7, the relative minor, all that.
You need to be teaching music, Silk. Damn, man.
I don't have the patience.
Yeah.
I'm telling people, I'm letting any kids listening, study your instruments and study about music.
Yeah. Well, Sil, I want to thank you so much for your time, and thanks for visiting with us today and just taking time out of your schedule. And we're going to be down there at Biscuits and Blues next weekend. You stay warm and take care of yourself, and we love you, Sil. We love you.
Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you, and we'll see you next weekend, okay?
God bless. Thank
take
you.
Care. All right, Sil. Thank you.
Have a great day, San Francisco.
You too, Sil.
Been a great time until I get there.
Okay.
I'll be looking forward.
You got it, baby. Bye. Sil Johnson, he's going to be in San Francisco next weekend. Thursday, Friday, Saturday at Biscuits and Blues. Get your tickets early. It's going to sell out. 2 shows a night.